Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett and it's my pleasure to welcome you here today on behalf of University College of Syracuse University. As you know, we'll be speaking today with the two candidates for the 24th Congressional District and once again Professor Grant Reher from the Maxwell School and the Campbell Institute at Syracuse University is here to moderate the discussion. So I have just one word for you, and that is vote on Tuesday. And so we will get to the candidates. As always, we will leave some time for questions from the audience, and I will try to spot you as best that I can with the microphone. So take it away, Professor Reher.
Okay, thank you, Sandra. What we'll do is we'll follow the format that we followed in the past at these events and also what we did last week with the sheriff's debate. And like the sheriff's debate, I want to try to go to school a little bit on the previous Campbell Conversations debate that I had with the two candidates and also some of the other debates that I've been watching as well. And also, like last week, I have three questions that I'll ask the candidates, plus a short question. Actually, it's really a comment that I'll make at the beginning. For those three questions, I'd like to ask each candidate to take no more than about 3 minutes to answer, to allow some time for follow-up and response, and also to give plenty of time to the audience to ask its questions. And I think, as both the candidates know, those are going to be the tough questions that come from the audience. And there's something I just want to mention. You know, please do sort of honor that time and share the time. Sandra did give me this gavel. I don't plan to use it. I don't want to use it, but it is here at the table. And something else that I didn't feel the need to say last week, but I'll say today. I imagine that some of you are here rooting for a side, and that's fine, but I'd like you to please hold those kinds of reactions for your applause that we're going to give to both of them at the end. So let me just start with the first part of this before we get to the questions, and this is basically two quick comments based on last night's debate, and I'm not looking for a response here, but let me start. Congressman Maffei, War and Peace was written by Tolstoy. And Mr. Katko, when you work for 20 years as a federal prosecutor, you are working for the government. So having established that, let me move on. So my first question is about foreign policy. It's a question for both of you, but the initial framing of the question is going to be for Mr. Katko. In our previous conversation on the topic of how to respond to the Islamic State, you rejected the option of committing ground troops, and you said that we should commit ground troops only as a last resort and that we weren't there yet. So can you give me a better idea of what a situation of last resort would look like? And can you tell me more about when you would commit troops in the Middle East or somewhere else?
Oh, sure. First of all, I'm happy to be here today, and I'm really pleased to see that so many people are taking part in this great democratic process. So thank you for being here, and seeing my alma mater's insignia over there on the Thursday Morning Roundtable is good. I'm a graduate of Syracuse Law School, and I love it here deeply, and I bleed orange. As far as the ISIS question goes and when it was appropriate to commit to ground troops, I've talked about that, or at least touched upon it. You have 60-second sound bites to use usually, and it's difficult to get your answer in quickly, but I'm glad I have a few minutes to elaborate. What we have with ISIS now is a threat to the United States. There's just no question about it. ISIS wants to do harm to Americans. In fact, they've beheaded several Americans on TV and repeatedly threatened us and told us that they want to do harm to us. My fear is that my concern is that we not wait till they come to the United States. And that if we can check them there, great. So what President Obama suggested was a bipartisan bill to combat ISIS through airstrikes and through funding of troops there, on the ground there. It's not an ideal situation. A lot of times those troops end up turning around and being our enemy. Like we funded the Taliban in Afghanistan, and they turned when they were fighting against Russia, and now the Taliban was our enemy. We had to go subsequently go and take them out. That is a problem. But the bigger problem is ISIS, and I don't think you can do nothing about it. I think we have to fight them there. And with respect to ground troops, I truly, in the bottom of my heart, believe it should be the last resort. Now, when does that happen, and how does that come about? Last resort to me is when, if I was in Congress and I was briefed by military leaders that we have to do this now, and there's a consensus built among all the leaders that it's such a national threat to us that we can't wait for them to get here, and we have to do something now. For example, if they overrun Iraq and they overrun Turkey, for example, what do we do then? I can't give you an exact bright line definition, but it would come from people who are who would be urging us as a matter of national security to do it. But let me caution you, as a last resort, I have a son that's in the ROTC program who's a sophomore, and there's no question that he would be highly likely put into harm's way if that decision was made 2 years down the road. And I do that with a heavy heart. And he wants to go now because he loves his country and he wants to go and fight them. But I think we have to go as a very last resort. And I think most military leaders will tell you that that is an option you cannot take off the table, because when you take it off the table, you take off a strategic advantage you might have for deterrence with ISIS. So the bottom line is this, in my mind, is a very last resort that you hear from military advisors and experts in the field that you must do this. Then and only then would I consider it.
Okay. Thank you. Congressman Maffei, going back to your first run in 2006, I think it's fair to say that you've always been very careful and cautious about committing ground troops. Can you talk a bit about when you would commit them?
I think if there's no other option, if the United States is directly attacked, if it's the only way to prevent a attack on the United States or our interests. But in this case, that's simply not true. ISIL is a threat. There's no question about that. But it's not the only threat. We also have Al-Qaeda still. There's Hamas. There are many other terrorist groups. We have an invasion of the Ukraine by Russia. All of these things we need to check before they come to the United States. But we can't send troops to all of them. And in fact, if we did, it wouldn't necessarily do any good. My biggest fear with the CATCO doctrine of they cut off people's heads, and we saw it on TV, it's terrible. But in my view, we're playing right into the terrorist hands by allowing it to look like the United States is going to war with this so-called Islamic State that's neither Islamic nor a state. That's exactly what they want. That helps them recruit. Look at us, we're taking on America. We can't allow that to happen. There is another way, and it doesn't involve ground troops, and it doesn't involve sending more weapons into a very war-torn area where they're more likely to be used against us and our allies, probably, than even the enemy. We have to help the Kurds. They're a very important group there. They're fighting very hard, men and women, fighting for their own freedom. We have to build a real international coalition where our partners will commit troops themselves, not just money. Biggest thing is we need to cut off the illegal oil trade. Stand up to our allies. Turkey sometimes is playing both sides of this. Make sure we cut off the funds for ISIL. Counterterrorism efforts, that may involve teams like SEAL Team 6, but very limited ways to make, and very targeted ways. And we do need targeted airstrikes for humanitarian purposes. The bill that I voted against, President Obama, actually did not have anything to do with airstrikes. It did talk about the Syrian training operations and putting trainers on the ground to train these so-called Syrian moderates. I'm not sure if there are the Syrian moderates or if we can identify them. And even if there are, they're fighting a two-front war, and we asked them to. Last year we asked them, we said, okay, stop focusing on ISIL and focus on Assad. This year we're saying, oh, no, we were wrong. Stop focusing on Assad and focusing on ISIL. That's not a good policy. So I've been very critical of the president. And where I disagree with Mr. Katko, maybe not in exactly what he says, but the fact that he's playing so many different sides of this. He was so quick to criticize me he was criticizing Obama, saying I wasn't holding the president accountable, criticizing me for everything I did. And then when I voted the other way, suddenly he's for the president and he's for Obama's plan. He had talked about sending troops. He got a little bit careless, said it a little bit too much. Then he made the paper retract that quote. So he brought it down to a last resort. I'm consistent. I don't believe we should send troops. I don't believe we should risk another land war in Iraq. Our military families have done enough over and over again. And unfortunately, for all those years in Iraq and for all those years in Afghanistan after we took care of the Taliban and got al-Qaeda out of Afghanistan, it didn't change our safety here. And that's why I think we need a different approach.
Mr. Katko, Congressman Maffei has invoked something he called the Katko Doctrine.
Also I've never heard referred of that before, to, but it sounds good.
Also referred to some other things that you said. So I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that, to clarify that.
Oh, sure. I don't know where he got the Katko Doctrine from. That's just a cute phrase. But the bottom line is, I don't think we can wait until al-Qaeda is here. And I completely disagree with you that our efforts over the last decade have been for naught. At the U.S. Attorney's Office, we routinely worked on joint terrorism task forces, and there's no question in my mind that multiple terrorist acts were stopped before they got here. There's absolutely no question in my mind. Now, do we get into a war without limits at times in the Middle East? Absolutely, and that's absolutely positively what I'm against. But I don't think we can wait until a threat is here. We can't ignore the threat. But as far as doublespeak goes, he's talking on one hand about not funding certain things or putting troops on the ground. Then he's talking about building a coalition to combat them. So I don't know if that means a coalition to fight ISIS together with others, or what is it? I'm not sure what you mean when you say coalition. But the bottom line is this, and it's not about being divisive or going back and forth. Mr. Maffei, he likes to try and engage me in that. That's not the point. We all have to get together as Americans. And you know what? The fact that I supported President Obama should be a good thing. Well, he's on the other side of the fence. I have a lot of problems with him. But at the same token, on this one, I think he got it right. I think he got it right because we as a country need to come together in times of crisis. And I do believe this is a budding crisis. And if we can stop it before it happens over here, great. And I can't be more emphatic. I do not want boots on the ground unless we are told it's absolutely positively necessary.
I want to move on to the next question, but Congressman, do you want to clarify the comment about the coalition that Mr. Katko made?
Well, I'd like to clarify a couple of things very quickly. First of all, I'm not saying that we haven't stopped a lot of terrorist attacks. We have stopped a lot of terrorist attacks, and we've done it in a very good way, and I admire our troops and our law enforcement for doing that. But that hasn't been because we've had large numbers of troops in Afghanistan and Iraq who themselves have become targets for terrorism. In terms of the coalition, it means just that. It means building a coalition with allies in the region or those who there's a lot of countries that have a lot to lose because of the ISIL. And they're looking to the United States to do their battles for them. I'm not saying that this isn't something that we need to stop abroad, but I am saying that our partners who are even more threatened, they need to do their part.
Okay, thank you. This next question is about budgetary issues, and I was actually thinking back a bit yesterday on this, and I believe that the last major party candidate for any federal level office to tell me directly that they were going to raise my taxes was Walter Mondale. I think I have that right. If someone wants to correct me, they can. Congressman Maffei, last night you came close. You suggested last night that those currently above the upper threshold for Social Security taxes should pay more, but the level where that would happen was left unspecified. I want to push you a little bit further on this. Aren't we going to have to raise more taxes than that at the national level if we really want to deal with the debt and the deficit in a responsible way?
All right. There's two topics here, so I want to try to unwind this a bit, because what I was talking about was the Social Security.
Right.
Social Security has contributed not one penny to the debt, not one penny. It is a program that's worked. People pay into it. People get out of it. Generations right now are paying into it. We all pay into it. I want to keep it that sacred trust. I want to keep it that guaranteed benefit that it's always been, because it's worked. It's brought us from over 50% of seniors in poverty to about 10%. And it's helped all of us. And it's helped people and seniors retire with dignity and people with disabilities. In order to do that, we need to find more funds for the future. And I suggest that we take that cap and we do something with it. We can change it, we can get rid of it completely, or if that's not acceptable to the Republicans, that's fine. We could pause it and have it come back at 500,000 or at a million. It wouldn't solve the entire problem if it was that high, but it would solve a lot of the problem, because people who made, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and there are people who make $50 million a year, they would be paying their Social Security on almost all of their income, just like middle class people. So that's where I am with that. In terms of reducing the deficit, I've suggested several specific things that would reduce the deficit. First of all, I supported the bipartisan budget bill, a bill that John opposes, but that had $85 billion in savings and is preventing a government shutdown until 2015. We do need to prevent those government shutdowns also, and sometimes that means compromising. I've suggested that prescription drugs be negotiated, the prices of those can be negotiated on behalf of Medicare. That would save $150 billion. I've suggested getting rid of the oil subsidies. These are subsidies to encourage oil companies to explore some accounting gimmicks and things like that. Those are the kind of things that oil companies are going to do anyway. It's not going to increase the cost of gasoline because these oil companies are already making record profits. Those are just a few of the ways. There's other ways, too, and I've joined with a coalition called the No Labels, and they're endorsed me. It's a bipartisan coalition to find where there are government efficiencies we could do in government waste. I've pointed to specific things in the budget to help get the deficit down. But what we can't do is balance the budget on the backs of middle class and senior citizens.
Okay, but I want to push you because I didn't hear an answer to the question. These things that you're talking about are kind of nibbling at the edges a little bit. They can do some kind of revenue savings, but really the question is, if we're really going to wrestle with the size of this debt and the deficit in some kind of responsible way, don't we have to put on the table and really seriously consider raising more taxes at the national level beyond the kinds of things that you're talking
about?
Well,
two things. If it pleases everybody, I'm all for looking at raising taxes on millionaires and billionaires, and have been for a long time. I've talked about the Buffett rule. I think that the wealthy should pay their fair share, and I actually said last night in a different question that I do think the wealthy should pay more and the middle class should be paying less. As a matter of fact, the burden is far more on the wealthy, and I'm not even talking about the mere wealthy. I'm talking about the super rich, and the burden is far less on them than it is on the middle class. But if we really want to pay down the deficit, if we really want to get rid of the debt, and by the way, the deficit's been cut in half from where it was, it still has to go a lot farther, but we have to grow the economy. Part of the challenge with this sort of thinking of, well, we have to, the only things we can do are budget cuts and tax increases, is that it assumes that the pie is the same size. If you assume the pie is the same size, then we shouldn't have any immigrants, right? Because then they'll just be taking more of our pie. And all we can do is condense. But the truth is you can't cut your way and you can't tax your way out of a debt. You have to grow your way out. And the way to do that is to make prudent investments, including investments in infrastructure. That's what made this country great. That's what the Roosevelts did. FDR, he had huge deficits because of World War II, but he also rebuilt the country. And they built an industrial society that was able to grow its way out of debt. More recently, Bill Clinton. Yes, they did some targeted tax increases. They did some targeted tax cuts. And they also did some infrastructure and some other kinds of investments. But they were able to grow the economy. And before anybody could believe it, we were suddenly running surpluses instead of deficits. The last time we have run a surplus, because a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president were bold enough to do that.
All right. Let me move on to the same question and a different version to Mr. Katko. Mr. Katko, you said on the Campbell Conversations that you were against the Ryan budget.
Yes.
On the principle that it cut Medicare and Social Security. You have talked about the waste and abuse in federal spending, but again, no respected analyst that I'm aware of thinks that we can really address the debt and the deficit through that approach alone. So again, how the same question to you, how are we going to deal with the debt and the deficit in a responsible way? Can we really take some kind of real tax increase off the table and be doing this seriously?
I have great faith in the American people. I have great faith in American ingenuity, and I have great faith that we can do this without having to raise taxes. Will I taking taxes off the table, raising taxes off the table completely and say absolutely positively never? Of course not. That would be irresponsible, and that's part of the problem in Washington. When you have these bright line politicians who say never this and never that, that's why we have what we have in Washington right now, the most broken era in the history of our country. Mr. Maffei was part of the least productive Congress in the history of our country. And part of it's because people took very extreme positions and that's it. So my answer to that is, can you take it off the table? No. Should you strive like crazy to make sure that we don't have to raise taxes as part of the overall budget package? Yes. And like Mr. Maffei noted, the budget deficit has been cut in half without having to raise taxes. And we're hoping to continue to do that. Now, a couple of things before. Well, I'll tell you, first of all, Government Accounting Office, for example, came out with reports, and they've updated them over the years. There's close to 200 programs and administrations that are overlapping in government. 200. So why not take a look at that overlap and streamline that? There is more than 77,000 vacant buildings in the United States that are owned by the government. Why is that? There is efficiencies. Is that going to be enough? I don't know. But that's what we should start doing. Instead of talking about the knee-jerk reaction of raising taxes every time we have a deficit, I think about to try and do everything we can to be as lean and mean as we can. And I kind of liken it to the factories that I've visited throughout this district. I am stunned, and I encourage all of you to go do it. Some of these factories, it's amazing. They're so mechanized, and one person is doing a job of what four people used to do. And they've streamlined everything they've had to because they're trying to survive. Okay, and they have efficiencies that will just knock your socks off. And that is the type of thinking we need to have in government. We're not there yet. And I'll give you one small anecdotal evidence of that. In the U.S. Attorney's Office in Syracuse, where I was presided over hiring for 15 years, we have to, even for an entry-level $30,000 a year clerk, we had to send the resumes to Washington so some bureaucrat could screen those resumes and then tell us whether or not those individuals are worthy of being interviewed. I think we have the ability to do that here in Syracuse. We know, I think we're smart enough to be able to make that decision. Now, that person down in Washington is probably getting paid $800,000 plus benefits, plus a retirement. Those are the types of efficiencies you need to look at. But can you take it off the table? Of course not. And the bottom line, Mr. Maffei did talk about tax increases repeatedly over the last, and he's talking about millionaires and billionaires and saying he wants to cut taxes for middle class. But here's the reality. He is talking about increasing taxes on Social Security by lifting the cap. There's people in this room that would be affected by that. There's just no question about that. And I venture to guess you people probably consider yourself middle class. While Mr. Maffei has never defined what the middle class is, the bottom line is he's advocating for a tax increase with respect to Social Security. He's not just talking about it. It's clear that's what he wants to do. I don't think you need to do that. I think as a last resort you do that. And I think that we have to, as a country, try find every efficiency we can. Because when you raise taxes, the economy generally stalls.
Let me move on to the third question here, and this is a question about where the two of you sit in your respective parties, and this has come up a lot in this campaign. It came up again last night. I think the underlying idea here is that the district is basically moderate. I went back and I looked at some things from the past, and again, I have two versions of the same question here. Mr. Katko, I'll start with you. It seemed like when you first set out on your path for Congress, you sounded fairly moderate, but you also said then that you rejected labeling, including the label of a moderate. Then there was some criticism from the more conservative wings of the local Republican Party, at which point I think some of your tone turned more conservative. And now you are giving yourself the moderate label. You did so again last night. So, what do you think are the three most important specific issue stands that help to mark you as a moderate?
Well, I think the most specific issue stands. Well, I wouldn't vote for the Ryan budget, first of all. And I look at the Ryan budget, and when you have some of the things that they have in there, I wouldn't vote for it. I would stand against it. That's one way. The second way, issue-wise, is I agreed with President Obama when he said that we need to have a bill for airstrikes in Iraq. That's another one. I consider myself a guy who reaches across the aisle and gets things done. For the last 20 years as a prosecutor, I've had to work with leaders from across the spectrum on a regular basis to put together coalitions, task forces, to combat crime and violence and make the neighborhood safer wherever I was, in Texas and in Puerto Rico and here in Syracuse. And when you do that, you have federal, state, and local law enforcement have vastly divergent priorities and vastly divergent practices, and you have to try and meld those and put them together. So for me, for the last 20 years, I've been nothing but a coalition builder and nothing but a leader in trying to get different people together. And in conjunction with the task forces, I also had to work with community leaders, whether they were Democrat or Republican, didn't matter to me. And I worked with reverends and ministers, and I had to sit in the living rooms of victims and try and work with them. And I didn't care whether they were Republican or Democrat. I wanted to help them. And I want to take that. So I guess the third issue for me is one of leadership based on my past track record. And that's the way I would look at it.
Thank you. Now, Congressman Maffei, you had a question last night about voting with your party. And I agree with you that that's not the statistic to use. There's lots of procedural votes, as you pointed out. So let me try another measure. The Americans for Democratic Action has been scoring members of Congress for years, and they're probably the most frequently sourced measure of a member's political ideology based on their voting. Each year they pick 20 important votes. They try to find ones that aren't just on party lines, and they create a 100-point scale of political liberalism. As of last week, they hadn't scored 2014 yet, but I do have scores for your other 3 years in office. And I want to compare you with the other members from this region, Bill Owens, Michael R. Curie from the past, and Richard Hanna. In 2009, you were 15 points to the left of Michael R. Curie. Owens hadn't voted enough to be rated in that year. In 2010, you were 20 points to the left of both Michael R. Curie and Bill Owens. In 2013, you were 20 points to the left of Bill Owens and 45 points to the left of Richard Hanna. So when the comparison is made to other members from this region, you do seem consistently to the left of them. So again, the same question. What are the three most important specific issue stands that mark you as a moderate?
Well, a couple of things. One, to go back to a slightly different question, but is relevant here, is John talked about a lot of different kinds of saving mechanisms. I've been working on those with a group called No Labels. No Labels actually is a bipartisan group. You can get on nolabels.org and you'll see some of the same things that he's been mentioning we've already been working on and in some cases have been implementing. I think that in terms of three particular issues, there are several issues. I brought up last night that I'm more conservative on taxes. I've crossed party lines many times to make tax cuts for small businesses and for individuals permanent, even though the Democrats have opposed that. On health care, I'm for the Affordable Care Act, but I've also stepped in to say that we shouldn't have the device tax. It's not important to the bill. It's just a pay-for. We can replace that and to do other kinds of things with that bill that make it easier to implement. So on those two issues, I've certainly been bipartisan. I do think that there's other areas as well. On immigration reform, I've accepted the bipartisan Senate bill. It's not everything that I want, but I do accept that. I'm for universal background checks for guns. I guess you can say, well, isn't that on the liberal side? But I'm not necessarily for everything in the SAFE Act. I think background checks make sense. And I was for the bipartisan budget agreement, which saved $85 billion. Those three things that I mentioned, the universal background checks, the immigration reform bipartisan, the bipartisan budget agreement, are all things that John has said he opposes. There are a lot of, look, nothing is perfect. Nothing is perfect. Being bipartisan, working with both parties, is really, at the end of the day, not about a number, certainly not about some rating from a Washington organization. It's about looking at every vote and looking at your district. My district is a little bit different than Bill Owens' district and you know, Michael R. Curie / Richard Hanna's district. But I work with those two gentlemen all the time for the good of all three of our districts. We work together on military issues. We work together on transportation issues. We work together on pre-K. I've been very supportive of Richard Hanna's pre-K bill. We get things done. Every issue that comes up, I look at individually, and I try to find where a consensus is, to the extent any consensus can exist in a very diverse district, and I try to do the best thing for the district. And frankly, I don't look at those numbers.
Okay. Thank you. So I think we should let the audience have at it. So I don't know who wants to ask the first question. Sandra's going to. Gentleman in the middle.
And I will try to in the back. Catch you in the order that I see you.
Yeah.
All right. Would you mind standing, though? Thank you.
I'd like to have you both differentiate from each other your position on what I would categorize as women's issues. Equal pay for equal work, a right for a woman to make her own decision about whether she wants an abortion or not, co-pay requirement for certain female services. In other words, I want to see how you differ on those issues.
And I want to interject something just that I forgot to at the beginning. On the audience questions, if I could ask each of you to be briefer, because we do want to try to get as many people in as we can. So I don't know who wants to start.
I'll take that. Okay. I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, there's been a lot of deception out there about my positions on this, and thank God you said that. I am emphatically for equal pay for women. I'm just against a bad bill. I'm emphatically for contraception. In fact, I think we should go one step further and really finally look at contraception as available, making it available over the counter. And on a personal level, I am opposed to abortion, except in instances of rape, incest, or life of the mother. That is generally consistent with my Catholic faith, but not continually, not completely so. That's my position. I realize on the abortion issue that people have differing views on that. Reasonable people are going to disagree, and I understand that completely. But that's simply based on my faith, that's where I am. And as far as the ads go, that's what's troubling about it. I have five sisters. I have a very strong mom who's an Irish Catholic, tough old bugger. And I have a very strong wife who's with me here today. And I can tell you without equivocation, I love them all dearly. They love me all dearly. But if I was against equal pay for women and if I was against contraception, I wouldn't have a heartbeat right now, okay? So let's make sure that's clear. And to the extent that those ads suggest otherwise, that's really troubling to me, because this election is about much more than divisive issues. And what's offensive to me, in a way, the way this campaign's been run, I'm offended for women, because as a segment, I think they're trying to manipulate women, and I think that's not right. I'll stand right up here, and I know women are in this room, and tell you my position on abortion. And you know what? That takes courage, because I know that you guys disagree. That's okay, all right? But that's the bottom line. I will answer the questions. I'm answering the questions for you right now.
Congressman Maffei.
I don't think women can be manipulated. All the women I know are very, very independent thinkers. Anyway, I am for equal pay for women. Obviously, it's a big issue I've been a leader on. Currently, women make 77 cents for every dollar a man makes nationwide. I'm not just for equal pay for women because it's a women's issue. I think it's a middle class issue. The better the middle class does, the better Central New York does. And women getting equal pay is very, very important for middle class families today. But we can't just be for it. We have to do something to make sure it happens. It's the 21st century. 77 cents of every dollar. It's not just going to happen. To sort of say there's laws that already exist, well, the courts have put holes in those laws by saying, okay, you can't discriminate against the sex of the person, but you can discriminate based on past salary history, for instance, or other kinds of things. If the person takes a lot of time off, a woman might take a lot of time off because she gets pregnant, for instance. So the Equal Pay Act, which is a bipartisan bill, it does that. And I'd be fine with John's position that he's for equal pay for equal work and against that bill if he would come up with another proposal that would get us there, but he won't do that. On contraception, being for contraception, that's great, John. I'm so glad. We've had contraception in this country for many, many years. I don't think that's a revolutionary thing, even for a Republican. But I will say this: when you're for businesses being able to deny to their employees coverage for contraception, it in effect says we don't trust women. We're for the business, the corporation's rights, or the family that owns that corporation's rights over that individual woman's rights. And I don't subscribe to that. And I am pro-choice, consistent with Roe v. Wade, because I do think it's an individual decision. The government shouldn't have any place in this decision. Whatever my personal views are is irrelevant, because if we're talking about the federal government, they should just stay out of it. I frankly still don't know what John's position is. He talks about his own personal position, and then he says he wants to repeal Roe v. Wade, or he's opposed to it. I really don't know exactly where he is on that. But I am pro-choice. I've always been pro-choice. I think we should, stay a country where the federal government stays out of women's health care decisions. And one of the reasons why I supported the Affordable Care Act is that it made women's health care the same price as men's. Before the Affordable Care Act, you were able to charge women more for their health care than men.
Let me ask you though to do it in a specific way. So, the three things here, I think, for a response, if you could briefly sketch out then what an alternative fair pay proposal might look like, what's your position then on the companies providing contraception or being mandated to by the government, and then third, this abortion policy question, the difference between your personal beliefs. Any abortion.
Sure.
But we could spend the rest of the time on this, so let's respond
Quick.
To that.
I gotcha. Well, the first thing, with respect to equal pay, The hard thing is not in that bill. The hard thing is exactly what he touched upon. If a woman takes time off to get to have a baby, for example, we have two things tearing at the fabric of the family these days. One is caring for our parents, and the other thing is caring for our children. And we have two income families now. That Equal Pay Act does nothing to address those issues. Nothing. We need, it's part of my economic plan. Job flexibility, incentivizing employers to give job flexibility, flexibility in hours, telecommuting, those types of things I think are more important and would be much better served to help people get back to equal pay. Because a lot of times equal pay is affected by they have to take time off for their children or a loved one, and again, having more flexibility in pay would be a good thing. With respect to the contraception issue, again, it's more deception. I simply commented on the Hobby Lobby decision. The Hobby Lobby decision made closely held corporations, closely held businesses like Hobby Lobby, who objected to contraception on religious beliefs, and they gave them the same rights as a person. I said it was a correct decision based on the law, because I'm a lawyer and I was analyzing from a legal standpoint, but it was a bad decision because it was based on a bad law, Obamacare. If Obamacare anticipated more of these things, you wouldn't have these bad decisions. And by the way, Mr. Maffei, more deception. There's 22 contraceptions mandated by Obamacare. The folks in Hobby Lobby objected to 4. The only 4 they objected to were the 4 that were abortifacients, or the morning after type pills. They didn't object to the 18 others that were part of it. So again, more deception. So I hope that clarifies it for you. And on the third thing with respect to abortion, again, it's my personal belief. And I don't believe that, you know, as a member of Congress, it's gonna be a major issue in the House side. I just don't. And if it comes up, we'll deal with it. But you know, people know what my position is, and that's it.
Gentleman in the back had his hand up. Oh, you're not gonna get that? Oh. Okay, sorry.
I said I would pick people in the
order. I'm sorry. I'll give you back the gavel.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. She said okay. You were right. All right. Clyde and Ed and then Clyde.
Yes, my question goes to, we've been talking about some individual rights here. I understand there's some proposals in Congress for a 28th constitutional amendment that goes to corporate rights. Actually, right now, being considered supreme over individual rights, the U.S. Constitution only talks about individual rights. I was wondering where each of you would come down on those type of proposals that, as I understand it, just began with some U.S. Supreme Court rulings at the end of 1970 and culminated in Citizens United, if you will, and just want to see both of you come on that.
I think yeah. Mr. Katkin went first last time. Why don't you go first, Congressman?
I do think that, unfortunately, a constitutional amendment is needed here. I say unfortunate because I think the Supreme Court has made a lot of wrong-headed decisions on these issues. They've essentially made equivalent a corporation or a special interest group, or some of the groups that don't even disclose their donors, or some of the groups that are buying ads in this race, $2 million on Mr. Katko's side. Actually, the NRCC is part of that, I should say. But it allows the equivalence of those private entities spending money on advertising to be the same thing as any of you getting up in the town square or as the newspaper publishing. I don't believe those are equivalent rights. And if we need a constitutional amendment, we need a constitutional amendment. The preamble to the Constitution doesn't say we the corporations, it says we the people. And it's relevant here because in the Hobby Lobby decision, Hobby Lobby is a big corporation. It may be closely held, but it's a big corporation. The corporation's rights take precedent over the woman's rights. And even if it is only four modes of birth control, I think individuals should make those kind of decisions for themselves, and neither corporations nor the government should be able to take a say. And they, you know, that, and that's, you know, my basic position.
I generally agree with Mr. Maffei with respect to what the developing laws has done with respect to corporations. So I definitely would engage in that discussion. I think we need to moving forward so we don't have more Hobby Lobby decisions going forward. And just as a point of clarification, he talks about outside money on my side and his side. I checked on that last night after the debate last night again. It's generally even. The biggest difference is he's outspent me 3-1 in his campaign with his personal funds. And you know what? So I think you've got to be straight with these people. The outside spending is generally even. And the difference is the fact that he's spending three times as much money on a campaign, and it's nothing about what he's accomplished. It's just trying to tear me down.
Would you please explain your position on the 1010 law, please?
What?
The minimum wage?
The 1010.
Oh, the minimum wage.
Is it the minimum wage you mean, Clyde?
Yes.
Yeah, minimum wage, sure. There's a proposal in Congress that is being propounded by the president to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. And there has been some very respected nonpartisan group has said that if you raise the minimum wage at $10.10 an hour, which is a very large one-time increase, it's going to lead to as many as 500,000 job losses for the very people you're trying to help, you know, in the minimum wage. I'm concerned about that. I don't think a law that cuts off its nose despite its face is productive. I would like to see the minimum wage increase on an incremental level so that the jobs are preserved. And I would like to see it as part of an overall tax reform package, because small businesses and manufacturers in this country face one of the highest corporate highest tax rates in the industrialized world. And it makes us much less competitive. So if there's an offset to the minimum wage so that these jobs are not lost, I'm okay with it. But as far as it is now in the current form, I can't vote for a bill that's going to cause job losses. And that's the bottom line. I think it was either Congressional Budget Office or Government Accounting Office, one of the two nonpartisan groups. Sure.
Congressman Fein.
I would like to see that study also, because most of the economists both Republicans and Democrats believe that a minimum wage on a gradual level does not cause job loss. America needs a raise. Median income in this country hasn't gone up in 30 years in any significant way. Raising the minimum wage is the first step to that. $10.10 an hour is, you just imagine living, trying to raise a family, even with two earners, on $10.10 an hour. But you at least got to get to there, because we're far lower than that right now. And our state has a somewhat higher minimum wage, which is good, but it really should be across the board. It should be a level playing field. Mitt Romney is for raising the minimum wage. Now, of course, I do think it should be combined with a package of help for small businesses. Most small businesses in this district pay far higher than the minimum wage, but that's okay. I still think that we should give that help, because there will be upward pressure on all wages once the minimum wage is increased. Again, it'll be gradual, but I'd like to make sure that that doesn't impact small businesses. But America needs a raise. To continue to be against it or to wait for the absolute perfect proposal to come along. In Congress, you can't vote maybe. You can only vote yes and no. It's one of the reasons why I've taken a lot tougher stands, I guess, in this campaign, maybe in a foolish way, because politically being, I'd say where I'm for. I appreciate, John, I don't even know now whether he is for the case in this Hobby Lobby case, because he seems to have switched during this.
I think
this
we're debate. Beginning to wander off topic here. Sandra, can we get to the next question?
The U.S. ranks somewhere in the middle in terms of educational outcomes for our kids. What role do you think Congress should have in helping to improve educational outcomes?
Congressman Fein.
I think educational outcomes are very important, and if we want to make education a national priority, then we have to have some more involvement than simply 7 cents out of every public education dollar coming from the federal government. Now, I don't believe that we should have the core so-called Common Core. I think that local school districts and local teachers know more. But in terms of outcomes and actually looking at where we are as a country, we need a broader commitment, not just for the education system, but for the economy. It worries me that our public schools are judged not by how much that they add to a child when they're going through the educational system, but they're judged only on how many years and where the child is. A child could come to them with virtually no reading skills at all at age, at ninth grade age, and then they teach the kid how to read, but they're failing school because the kid isn't at graduation level, where a suburban school district, the child could come in far above their reading level, go nowhere, but graduate from high school, and they would be judged better. So we need to talk about educational outcomes, and we need to do more in a rational way. And at the risk of being reined in because I'm off topic. I also think that we need pre-K and preschool education, and that should be a federal priority. Why? Because studies say over and over again that it's the number one way to equalize opportunity. If my daughter will have read so many more words, unfortunately, she will have read so many more words than somebody who's less fortunate than her and has a different kind of background. But we can help equalize that with pre-K and with pre-education.
Mr. Kanko.
I generally agree with much of what he's saying, but the bottom line is this. I think that Common Core is a good example of when people from Washington try to dictate local policy what happens, and it's not working. We're teaching kids now to take tests instead of teaching them how to think critically, and that's a problem. I think loosening up the requirements that are tied to federal dollars is a good start. I also think we need to take a look at something that no one talks about, and that is what's happening in our urban schools, because that's dragging down a lot of the issues here. The urban schools in this district, in Oswego, in Fulton, in Auburn, and in the city of Syracuse, have dramatically lower performance rates than the suburban school districts. The suburban school districts, generally, you can put those kids up against anybody, and they're going to do just fine. But it's the urban school districts that are getting killed. Fowler has less than a 50% graduation rate. And if you really want to think about it, and you want to get an example of how I'm a moderate Republican, I think that poverty is a huge issue in the city of Syracuse. We have the 23rd poorest impoverished city in the country, 23rd, and there's no outrage. And to me, it starts with the fundamental building blocks of nutrition and trying to help these kids in the inner city. And you know what? And another thing I think we should do is take some of the energy that people showed towards those immigrant children that were going to come to Syracuse, and let's turn that inward to our cities. And let's develop mentoring programs and more attention being paid to the inner cities, because unless we raise the standards for these kids in the inner cities, people are going to struggle. And I think that's part of the overall matrix. But the bottom line is we spend an awful lot of money on education, and I think having government-centric education from Washington just isn't working. And I have great faith in local teachers, and I don't think you can teach a kid in Los Angeles, California, the same way you teach a kid in Weedsport, New York, or in Syracuse, New York. It's different. You need to have the local flavor to teach these kids. You need to have generalized standards, but you need to unshackle these local teachers to do their job.
Sandra?
I actually came here today because I have to vote because I'm going to be gone. And I was interested in me sort of seeing you face to face. But I'm concerned because I give you the right to not believe in abortion and the women's right to choose. But I don't give you the right to put your beliefs on all of us. You should be voting for what is best for the area that you're representing. My question is, how do you feel on that? I mean, you should be representing us, not representing yourself.
Listen, I can only tell you where I stand, and you have to make your decisions accordingly, and I completely respect that. And I mean, what else more can I say? And I wish you well.
Thanks, Sandy. Good morning. Mr. Kakko, you just made a comment about focusing funds on people living in poverty in the inner city as opposed to refugees and new Americans. I guess my question is how do you discern between the two? My son went to Dr. Weeks, and I think there were 18 to 25 different languages spoken there. I see those two groups as significantly overlapping and facing some of the same challenges. Could you please respond?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you may have misapprehended what I was saying because those kids are here. That's what I'm talking about. People that are here, okay? And the whole flap with the kids coming into Syracuse and all the passion showed to want to help those kids, my feeling is why not help the kids that are here now? And, of course, that is immigrant kids. They're, on the Fowler soccer team, I think the kids spoke 16 different languages, and they had to communicate by clicking because, you know, that's the type of stuff I want to help, okay? I think if your kid goes to school in the inner city, you'll agree with me. Some kids have it really tough, and I saw it every single day as a gang prosecutor. I would walk up the back steps of houses or stairwells, inner stairwells, dark stairwells, the creaking steps, trying to find a witness and knocking on that door, not knowing what's going to happen when that door opens up, which made me earn my gray hairs. But when that door opened up, some of the poverty I saw was positively jaw-dropping, okay? And I'm not saying you just throw money at the situation. I'm saying as a community, we need to all come together to try and, I think we first of all need to recognize the fact that poverty is a huge issue with respect to education. And poverty is a huge issue in the city of Syracuse. And you can't solve it just by throwing money at it. You gotta solve it by having more community input and people from, like where I live in Camillus, taking ownership and helping kids and mentoring kids. Like, I don't know if you saw the commercial with Abrianna Sullivan, she's a young African-American woman. I befriended her and I've been kind of a guide to her. And I'm confident that I helped her on her path to now be graduating from OCC and now she's at Lemoyne pursuing a degree. She comes from a very tough area and she has a very tough background. And that's the types of things I'm talking about. And I think if you're here, we have to help you. So I hope that clarifies it for you.
I would like to respond.
Okay, the question was to Mr. Kakko, but briefly. Okay, go ahead.
Well, I do know in the inner city schools because I went to them. I mean, I went to Nottingham and I went to Central Tech. My brother and sister both work in the city school district. My mother is retired from the city school district. I do think, obviously, I think poverty is a big issue in the schools. But I do think, again, it's unfair to judge all these schools by their outcomes. I support a lot of the poverty programs that John has been talking about. Unfortunately, his party has blocked them. I hope he will be, I'm sure he does. I mean, I know he's sincere and is caring, but in terms of the getting these policies through, I just hope that he'll be as strong when he gets to Washington, even though the people who've come up to campaign for him have all been opposed to what he's saying.
Well, the Democrats have an ally in me when it comes to poverty. How's that?
Fred.
You, Mr. Kakko, you mentioned not throwing money at a problem as being the only solution, and Mr. Maffei mentioned investments that need to be made. And I think it's a follow-on to what you just talked about disinvesting, that we have a party, the Republicans seem to be wanting to disinvest to contract the size of government. And would you resist efforts to contract, to reduce size? Where would you invest? And Mr. Maffei, the same question.
Oh, I definitely think you can do both. You have to, when I'm talking about contracting the size of government, I'm not talking about taking away food stamp programs, and I'm not talking about taking away anti-poverty issues or taking away infrastructure. I'm talking about making the government more efficient from an operational standpoint. And I cited a lot of those things. But I also think from an infrastructure standpoint, we have to spend money. And one of the things I proposed, for example, last night, and I've been talking about it on the campaign trail quite a bit, is the National Highway Trust Fund, for example. Right? In addition to other ways we can make the efficiencies, the National Highway Trust Fund, for example, has two components of it. It's kind of like what happened to the New York State Thruway system, taking on the Erie Canal problem and draining monies away from the Thruway Authority. We have the National Highway Trust Fund where you pay 18 cents for every gallon of gas. It's supposed to go towards roads and bridges and infrastructure, right? Well, a big chunk of that goes towards mass transit. And mass transit doesn't pay into that fund. There's no surcharge or anything on mass transit tickets. So that's bleeding it away. So one thing I would like to see, for example, would be to take the National Highway Trust Fund and do one of two things. Either split it off from mass transit completely and have mass transit create their own fund, or to have mass transit start contributing to the National Highway Trust Fund so we can make that fund more solvent. You do that, you can turn around and start fixing the roads and bridges the way you're supposed to and the infrastructure here. So I think you can do both, and you have to think about doing both. And I truly believe that we have enough spirit and know-how in America to do that.
I think I've already talked about the various ways to save money. I've talked about negotiating drugs and drug prices with Medicare and the no labels agenda. I do think we need a new reinventing government, so I am for government efficiency. I do think we need to make investments, and I think when you make capital investments and things like infrastructure and scientific research are different kinds of spending because they are capital investment. You're getting something that's going to see a rate of return. I had this conversation with Ben Bernanke, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he agreed with me that we need to have a different kind of budget, just like businesses would or local governments. I will say this, I think it's a huge mistake to separate transit from the Federal Highway Trust Fund. Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan was a champion of something called intermodalism. When you have people riding the bus or taking the trains, that takes pressure off of our roads. It takes pressure off of our bridges. It is very relevant to this, to the trust fund. If you just see it as roads and roads and roads, we're just going to have more and more and more cars, potentially polluting more and more. We're not going to have, we're not going to ever be able to have things like light rail. Our bus system won't be made more. It'll be basically cut off because I don't know where these funds are going to come if not from the Highway Trust Fund. Transit is a very, very important element of this, and it's a huge element for our economy. And you want to talk about the poor? A lot of people can't afford cars. And if you were to cut transit in this way, say transit, you're on your own, people wouldn't be able to get to work. And the best way to fight poverty is to give people a job and to get, let them have the capability to get themselves to work and earn their own living and have their own dignity.
Let me briefly respond to that.
Very quickly, because yes. I want to try to fit one more question.
No one's talking about cutting transportation, so please don't put words in my mouth. I'm saying that they need to contribute to the fund, either in conjunction with the National Highway Trust Fund or on their own. Either way, no one's talking about cutting transportation.
Okay, thank you. This is the last question here.
I'd like a straight yes or no answer. Do you support the repeal of Roe v. Wade from each candidate, please? Just yes or no.
From a personal standpoint, yes.
If you were a member of Congress, would you vote yes or no?
Yes.
No.
Thank you.
Thanks to the candidates.